Shalom and welcome everyone to the ICJ webinar series. I'm your host for today, David Parsons, and welcoming you to our TV studio at the headquarters in Jerusalem of the International Christian Embassy. And now we want to bring you this week a briefing, update regional security briefing that was given to us during the Feast of Tabernacles just a week or so ago. When we had over 500 Christians from 55 nations here. It's the largest solidarity mission to Israel since the war began on October 7 of last year. And we had a security briefing by former IDF spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus. It was excellent. We want to share this with you. And so let's go to his introduction at the Feast of Tabernacles.
We've been fighting a war that we didn't start for about a year. Sadly, we have almost 800 military casualties and more than 1,000 civilian casualties. We are fighting on 7 active fronts as we speak, and I will speak about a few of them in certain detail and a few of them in less detail. And it's a war that I think, as every day goes by, we understand that it is a war that will be, that'll take a long time to win. But I think more and more Israelis and more friends of Israel around the world are waking up to the understanding that there is no other option but to fight and win, even if it takes a very long time. So what I would like to do for the about 20 minutes or so is share my analysis of the current military situation, speak about the challenges and a few opportunities that we face, and then spend the rest of the time with taking and hopefully answering your questions. So if we speak about the three main combat theaters, I'll start first with Gaza. The situation in Gaza is that about a year or so after the war started, with what probably will go down in our history as the single worst day in Israeli history, definitely the single worst day in Jewish history post-Holocaust, and a day that I think we Israelis will, and especially those who served in the military, will forever remember in shame. The fact that our enemies were able to do what they did against us, against our civilians, our women, children, and abduct 252 Israelis, of whom 101 are still in Hamas captivity more than a year after, is a tremendous shame and the deepest sorrow in our memories. We still have a very strong commitment to bring our brothers and sisters back from that captivity. I'm happy to hear the IDF spokesperson, Admiral Hagari, mention that each and every briefing that he gives in Hebrew and in English. There's not a briefing that goes by that he doesn't remind whoever needs to be reminded that this is the ultimate moral responsibility that we have, is to bring our brothers and sisters home from these murderers. A year after the war started, Hamas is down but not out yet. They've taken significant blows. Out of the 3 goals that the Israeli cabinet told the Israeli military to perform, to dismantle their military capabilities, to dismantle their administrative capabilities, and to bring back the hostages, none of these goals have been achieved in full yet. The military one, I would say that Israel is quite close. Today, if you take stock of Hamas's military capabilities, they are maybe 10% of what they had prior to October 7. In terms of the amount of rockets that they have, the amount of trained combat personnel, their leadership, senior and mid-level or mid-level leadership, their arsenal of weapons, their infrastructure, their tunnel network, and their ability to conduct military operations. I say that because Israel has, of course, given them a lot of opportunities to try to lash out. Israel eliminated Ismail Haniyeh. People may have forgotten it was a month and a half ago, and a lot of terrorists have died since. But he was eliminated in Tehran, and the only thing that Hamas could do then was to fire three rockets towards Kiryat Gat. None of them hit, and no Israelis were wounded. And that was it, what Hamas did after Israel took out the leader of Hamas in the heart of darkness, Tehran. And that's indicative of their real military capabilities. Yahya Sinwar, the evil, genocidal mastermind of October 7 and of most of Hamas's capabilities today, was eliminated in a chance encounter in a room full of believers. I would definitely say that there was more than luck involved. And thank you. And I think that quite amazing to see that ordinary Israeli soldiers, not special forces, not Mossad agents with exploding beepers, and not anything special of any kind, ordinary infantry and ordinary armored soldiers, just happened to see Yahya Sinwar and his close entourage as they were scurrying from one secret location to another and engaged without knowing that it was Yahya Sinwar, as they would. They were out on patrol, saw enemy combatants, engaged first a tank, fired a few rounds towards the house where they were holed up to soften up the target. Then the troops, being wary of booby traps, IEDs, and all kinds of tricks that the enemy does on the battlefield, instead of going in themselves, they sent a drone. And I'm sure that you've all seen the footage of that drone that went in. And then they saw Yahya Sinwar covering his face behind cloth, and sitting wounded, already significantly wounded, in an armchair, trying to throw a piece of wood at the UAV in order to shoo it away, in order not to be discovered. Once the troops saw that there was still a live terrorist in the building, they ordered the tank to fire another few rounds, and eventually they went in to verify that he had indeed been killed. And that's when they saw that this guy looks familiar, and started to analyze it, and it appeared that it was indeed Yahya Sinwar. But so that happened, by the way, if we can pull out the map, that happened, by the way, in Rafah, the same Rafah that Israel was told multiple times, you mustn't, you shouldn't go into Rafah because of a plethora of reasons, none of them real, but we were told so many times, you mustn't go into Rafah. But since Israel went into Rafah, Israel has dismantled Hamas's infrastructure of tunnels along the border. Israel has saved four hostages from that location. Israel has killed countless hundreds, if not thousands, of Hamas armed terrorists in that location. And finally, Israel, with the good fortune and luck, was able to take out the leader of Hamas in that very same Rafah. Now, that teaches us something, indeed. It teaches us something about listening to advice and listening to what people around the world, even close friends, tell us we can and cannot do and should and shouldn't do. So what we have in Rafah is there's still a few Hamas operatives there scattered, I would say, relatively demoralized and not a cohesive fighting unit. The last days, I think, have been very difficult for Hamas as an organization to try to chart a way forward. What Israel has done is to offer Hamas leaders some kind of amnesty. If you surrender now, if you hand yourself over, and most importantly, if you hand over the hostages, all 101 of them, we can end the war now, and we can spare all of the horrors and bloodshed and destruction that's going on in Gaza. So far, no answer from Hamas, and every day that goes by indicates that it's not going to be a positive answer. But Israel, the first thing that Israel did, the prime minister actually did, and we've done it through back channels as well, was to extend that hand and to say to Hamas, if you care about the future of Gaza, civilian suffering, etc., we actually do. We most importantly want our people back. If you do want to end it now, now is an opportunity. Now, thank you. Now, Hamas's center of gravity has shifted from inside Gaza, inside the Gaza Strip. Everything was kind of centralized around Yahya Sinwar and his close entourage, his brother, who is probably going to take over his responsibilities and control. And now most of the power has migrated to Little Qatar. I'll eventually click my way to it. Little Qatar, which is far, far away. I don't have a pointer here, but you can see where Qatar is. That is where Hamas's leadership is now. They're still enjoying good life, luxury hotels, and the old new leader of Hamas, Khaled Mash'al, he is in Qatar today. Just to remind everybody here, Qatar is a senior non-member ally of NATO. And there's a significant U.S. base and other infrastructure in Qatar. And Qatar enjoys quite a lot of Western support. Now is the time to apply pressure on Qatar, to apply pressure on Hamas, to bring back the hostages and end the war. That is the time to do that now. Now, that's where we stand in the south. To be frank, as long as Hamas continues to control the distribution of food, and as long as Hamas administers sanitation, and as long as UNRWA is present in Gaza, Israel will not have achieved its second and most important goal of eradicating Hamas and its political control over Gaza. And we will not have solved the problem. So, out of three goals, one has almost been achieved, and I would say we're very close to achieving it, the military. The second, administrative, basically prying Hamas's dead fingers from the control over Gaza. That is what Israel needs to do now. And the next battle that you will see, and the next media attention and issue that will be covered, will be the distribution of food. And what you will most likely see is Israel ramping up the provision of food into the Gaza Strip. And I think that there are chances that Israeli soldiers, despite it being a very challenging and resource-intense target or resource-intense job to do, Israeli soldiers will start administering food and humanitarian aid themselves in order to push Hamas out of the picture. That's where the deliberations are now between the Israeli cabinet and the IDF, looking at ways of doing that. Had the IDF not been fighting on two additional fronts, Lebanon and in Judea and Samaria, I think we would have been there already. But it's simply a task that will be very demanding and require lots of troops and lots of security. That's the only reason why it hasn't happened so far. And once that happens, then that'll be a very important step towards dismantling Hamas's control over the Gaza Strip. Now, if we speak about a few other of the areas of operations, this is the border with Israel, between Israel and Lebanon, 120 kilometers, 80 miles, from the Mediterranean Sea on your left and Mount Dov and the Syrian border on the right. Israeli troops are currently deployed in southern Lebanon. There are four division combat teams operating in southern Lebanon as we speak. Regular and reserve soldiers are there with lots of air support and artillery support and logistics and intel and cyber. And what they're doing is operating in a limited and very, I would say minimalistic, but limited maneuver, which is targeted only at the extremely close perimeter to the border, where Israeli troops are going house by house, room by room, clearing each and every Lebanese house from Hezbollah infrastructure. I don't know if you've seen the videos coming out of southern Lebanon, if you've seen what the IDF has been discovering there, but it is massive. What Hezbollah built under the sleepy eyes of UNIFIL in southern Lebanon, of the UN troops deployed there, is a tremendous infrastructure that was all of it embedded within Lebanese civilian homes. And all of it was designed to have ready to go, ready to use forward positions for their elite stormtroopers to invade into Israel and to do an October 7 style attack against Israel like Hamas did from Gaza. The difference being that Hezbollah are much better equipped, much better organized, had even better intel, and that they would be attacking across a border that's 120 kilometers wide and not an area that is 45 or 50 kilometers wide, making it even more difficult for us to defend. And that along the border with Lebanon, there used to be many more Israeli civilians in communities than we had along the border with Gaza. So in any case scenario, had Hezbollah acted and executed their plan, we would have witnessed something that would have been by orders of magnitude worse, far, far worse than what Hamas did on October the 7th. That is what Israeli troops have prevented. That is what they are now dismantling in southern Lebanon. The images coming out of southern Lebanon and out of Gaza, for that matter, are not pretty ones. There's a lot of destruction. And every house that the IDF goes in, searches and finds Hezbollah infrastructure, weapons, tunnels, hideouts for fighters, Hezbollah fighters, perhaps an anti-tank position or an intel position, cameras, etc. Each and every location is dismantled. So what you see are Lebanese villages where there's perhaps three or four houses still standing, a mosque and a few other houses still standing, and that's it. The rest is being leveled and the tunnels are being detonated and collapsed in order not to have that infrastructure available for Hezbollah for whenever this war ends and whenever people return to southern Lebanon. That is in order to make sure that Israelis can go back to northern Israel. And for those who have forgotten, 70,000 Israelis are still internally displaced refugees in their own country for about a year. And they still don't have a date that our has told them, you're going to be able to go back in a week, in two, in a month, in 2 months. They're still homeless, homes destroyed, businesses destroyed, kids not going to school, lives uprooted brutally. And the only thing that they did wrong was to live in northern Israel and to have horrible neighbors on the other side of the border. But I am pretty confident that at the end of the war, this will change and that they'll be able to go back home. For me, by the way, if you ask what is victory, victory isn't all of the terrorist leaders killed in magnificent or less magnificent special operations. It isn't blowing up all of Hezbollah's long-range missiles, and it even isn't, and I'll speak to this in a second, taking out the evil Iranian regime. All these are very good and important things that should, and I believe will, happen. But victory, in my mind, will be when you'll be able to come back here in a year or two, and they'll take you to Metula, northern Israel, really the finger of the Galilee, the very tip of northern Israel. And you'll speak with locals there, and they'll complain that there isn't enough room for kids in the kindergarten, and they're all full with young Jewish children. When we come back, and when you will see that, and I believe that you'll have the opportunity to do so soon enough, to see the beautiful northern Israel flourishing again, full of hard-working, honest Israelis cultivating the land, tending to their people, growing families, and doing what they're supposed to do in our ancestral homeland, then that will be victory. Everything else is details leading up to it, but the real victory is with resettling and reclaiming what is so very, very rightfully ours. Now, I alluded to Iran. I won't speak about the Palestinians. We could speak many more minutes about Hezbollah. We could speak about the situation in Judea and Samaria. We're looking at the southern part of, this is Judea, south of Jerusalem, and this is the Judea and Samaria, what some people for odd reasons call the West Bank, but I use the biblical terms. There's a lot going on here. We don't have enough time to go into details if anybody wants to ask about it, but I'll just say that Hamas was successful on October the 7th in invading into Israel and dealing us a severe and humiliating blow, killing Israelis and abducting Israelis. They were not successful, and this is strategically very important, in actually exporting their military activity from Gaza to Judea and Samaria. And by and large, Palestinians have heard all of Hamas's propaganda, and they are subjected to a lot of incitement and propaganda from Hamas and from Iranian agents, but they're still deciding not to take to the streets and not to launch a third intifada. And that's not something that we should take for granted. That could make our situation even more challenging. It hasn't happened, despite the fact that there is tremendous military activity. There isn't a night that goes by where Israeli security forces don't go into one or more Palestinian cities to arrest, based on very accurate live intel, terror operatives. The sad story is, and I heard the pastor speaker or the lead priest speaking before about the situation with the Palestinians. The sad situation is that the Palestinian Authority has all but lost control over all of areas A. They do not govern anything but Ramallah and small parts of Bethlehem. All of the other cities are lost to other gangs of terrorists. And what we're seeing is a well-orchestrated and sadly well-executed effort by Iran to flood this area with additional weapons, lots of weapons. And every once in a while, you can even hear Palestinian officials, PA, Mahmoud Abbas and his people, complain about Iranian interference in Palestinian affairs. Even they say it. So it's not only Israelis speaking about it. Even the Palestinians themselves say that the fact that the Iranians are able to smuggle in weapons across the Jordanian border, they have a smuggle network that goes, let's see if we have the appropriate map here. So, yeah. So this map, you can see Jordan and you can see the southern part of Syria a little bit. What they've basically done is that the Iranians have a smuggling network from Iran through Iraq, Syria, and then through the northern, northwestern part of Jordan and then into Judea and Samaria. And their strategic objective is to destabilize that area as well. And sadly, they've been able to, for quite many months to flood that area with lots of weapons. That's one of the drivers of the instability there, and that is what Israeli forces are operating against, and we can expand on that topic in the questions. Last point before we go to questions. So, I think that we must acknowledge and give credit to our enemy, Iran. For the last at least 20 years, some would argue more, has been driving a very well-planned, disciplined strategy against Israel, whereby they have built a ring of fire around Israel by different Arab proxies, some of them close, like Syrian proxies. There's about 15 different terror organizations, different Syrian proxies, Iranian proxies in Syria. Some of them are really close, like Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Gaza. Hezbollah, of course, the biggest and most dangerous one in Lebanon. Proxies in Iraq, and some of them are further more away, like the Houthis in Yemen. But all of these organizations are funded directly and equipped directly by Iran. And for many years, we, the Israeli government, allowed Iran to get away with this strategy of building proxy organizations, of bleeding Israel. Think of it as a death by a thousand cuts. That's the Iranian strategy, a war of attrition. The target date that they have is 2040. And there's a countdown in a square in Tehran called Palestine Square, where they're counting down from year 2040, because this is the target date for the destruction of the Jewish state, according to the Iranian regime. And some people around the world take this lightly and say, well, they're not serious, and this isn't going to happen, and it's just, you know, domestic rhetoric. It's to divert the attention of the masses to other things external and not to their internal suffering. Fine, we've been there before with other Muslim dictatorships and we've dealt with them, but I wouldn't take this lightly. And when a regime as well-organized, as disciplined, and as fanatic as the Iranian regime has a target date and they're building nuclear weapons, I think we should pay attention to it and take it very seriously. Now, what the Iranians have been doing for many years and getting away with is fighting us indirectly. I think that in the last 2 months or so, we are in perhaps a strategic shift where Israel is crossing, I hope we eventually will, where we eventually will cross a very important Rubicon, and that is to shift our strategy versus Iran and to engage them directly in retaliation for their indirect and direct attacks against us. And the message is that we're not going to allow you to conduct this indirect warfare against us. And when your proxies attack us, we will see it as a direct attack from Iran, and we will retaliate accordingly. We're not there yet. That isn't what Israel is saying yet, but I think that is where we will be in the not too distant future. And I think that in the coming days, perhaps weeks, but probably days, Iran will suffer the consequences of its second brazen attack against Israel. I think that what Israel will do will be far more significant than how we responded last time, which was really a extremely minimalistic response to Iranian aggression out of political and diplomatic considerations. But I think that this response will be different and that it will be very meaningful, and hopefully it will constitute a strategic shift when it comes to Israel and Iran. To summarize, before we do a few questions, and I went a little bit longer than what I was supposed to, I apologize. I'll say the following. I don't know how long this war will take, and how many more months and years we will have to fight it. It puts a tremendous strain on Israeli society, economy, on our reserve forces and our regular troops, on their families and spouses, specifically the wives who are carrying a tremendous burden as the men go to fight, whether it's in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Judea and Samaria, or other locations. Many at the beginning of this war thought that this generation of 18 to 20-year-olds that we have fighting in the IDF now was a lesser generation. In Hebrew, some Israelis spoke about the TikTok generation. But I think that we can say 1 year after, and with significant, not complete, but with significant military success on all battlefields against Hezbollah, against Hamas, and against Palestinian terror organizations in Judea and Samaria, and against Iran and the Houthis and Iranian proxies in Syria and Iranian proxies in Iraq. All of them are being pushed back, some more than others. And I, as someone who used to be part of the IDF, am very, very thankful for the fact that we have these brave young men and women fighting for us and defending us. So thank you for that. Thank you for that, and thank you again for coming. And now I'll try to answer your questions.
Lieutenant Colonel, thank you so much. So we have an opening question by our Senior Vice President, David Parson. Okay, I have a 10-part question. Now I'll keep it to two. First of all, Jonathan is retired from the IDF and not in uniform, so he can speak a little more freely to us now. But there's this whole debate within the cabinet and with the U.S. administration about what sort of target list should Israel be going for in response to what Iran did with 180 ballistic missiles a couple of weeks ago. Where are you? Should it be nuclear? Should it be oil facilities? Should it be just military regime symbols? And second, tell us how Israel has this incredible, incredible intelligence to know right where someone is at any moment. And I don't know, you know, if you can just say anything about it, because it has been mesmerizing.
Thank you, sir. So the first part, for those of you who are, I mean, all of you research the internet, for those of you who are on X, I tweeted a series of maps that FDD experts compiled 2 weeks ago, where they analyzed, and these are real high-level Iran experts, Iran military, Iran regime, Iran society, and Iran nuclear. And they came together and did three maps, one of the more important nuclear military sites, one of the regime sites, and a third one of the classic military sites of significance in Iran. And we spoke about that, and we assessed what the IDF would strike. And then we presented it. I presented it on CNN, and I think a lot of people have seen it since. I think while interesting and, of course, very important, I don't think that is really the heart of the matter. I think that what's most important is, what does Israel want to achieve? What is the strategic objective? Because striking any of these or all of those combined is possible with risk, with consequences, with the possibilities of escalation and Iranian and other retaliation and many things that have to be factored in. But I think that if Israel decides to, it can strike any or all of those families of targets. What I think is the most important thing is, what does Israel want to achieve? Without going into military secrets, I can say that Israel can strike many, if not all, of their nuclear facilities and inflict significant damage. But there's a question mark of, how long will that damage last and what will the eventual long-term effect be? As long as the regime is in power, they will rebuild. And as long as they have enough money to sustain the oppressive regime and to continue their military nuclear program, I'm sure they will prioritize it because it's a matter of national strategy and importance for them. So unless we take out each and every scientist, each and every location, each and every centrifuge and research facility, there will be a nuclear Iranian program, even if we do a very successful military strike on 10 to 15 locations, including those that are buried deep underground in heavily defended bunkers and locations. That leads to the regime. In my mind, what Israel needs to do is to comprise a comprehensive national strategy that says we are going to apply, no pun intended, maximum pressure on the Iranian regime, and we are going to force them to change their strategy, to change their strategy towards us. I don't care what the Iranians do with Pakistan or with other countries, their neighbors, not so much our business. Our business is when they threaten us, when they build capabilities, when they fund our enemies, when they provide weapons to our enemies, and when they incite and build capabilities against us. That's our business. And what I think we should be doing is to have an economic, information, diplomatic, and military strategy against the Iranian regime. Up until now, I think Israel has had some success in delaying the nuclear military program. Obviously not enough because it's still there and there are still lots of scientists and it's advancing. And today, Iran has enough fissile material to build 15 nuclear bombs. Not quite sure that they have a bomb yet, as in the combination of fissile material, detonating device, all packed into a warhead that can withstand the challenges of traveling, whether it's on a truck or more complex in a missile. Not sure that they have that, but they definitely, in terms of enough centrifuges and enriched material, they've checked that box and they have the ability to produce much more in a short period of time. And this used to be what the world, this used to be the benchmark. How much enriched uranium do they have and to what level of enrichment have they gone? Are they 20? Are they 60? Are they 90%? And that's all been checked. Done. The Iranians have crossed all of those thresholds and they have enough cascaded or connected centrifuges, advanced and fast ones, to do so very rapidly in the future as well. So for me, the answer is the regime. That is what Israel should be focusing on. And Israel should be doing it together with its allies. I don't think that we can make any meaningful change in the Middle East without the U.S. I think that there are many countries in the region that would be happy, first behind the scenes and like a child that clings to the apron of his mother, but then perhaps more in the open, actually fighting against Iran. And I wish those countries would be braver to do so out in the open sooner, but we'll take what we can get. And I think that there is definitely necessity, time, capacity, and for all of those other countries, the US, Saudi, Emirates, Jordan, Egypt, and many other countries, it's really front and center of their national security interests. And the good thing for them is that Israel is, as always, willing to do the heavy lifting. Just like Israel did in 1981 against Saddam Hussein's nuclear program, when we unilaterally took it out and struck Osirak, just like Israel did in 2007, when Israel took out Bashar al-Assad's nuclear military program in Deir ez-Zor. At the time, Israel didn't get any praise. We were actually scolded. But afterwards, many world leaders came around and said, thank you, Israel, for ridding us of two possible tyrants with nuclear weapons. So I think we should be focusing on the regime. but it should be part of a big, comprehensive, and well-thought-out strategy. Intel-wise, quickly, it hurts to say, but you can see the difference between how well and how granular the intelligence is when it comes to Hezbollah, and how abysmal it was when it comes to Hamas. We failed miserably in assessing our enemy, understanding their strategic intentions, and assessing their military capabilities when it comes to Hamas. And it's almost a mirror image when we look at Hezbollah. I think one of the webinars that we did, I spoke about the threat assessment about Hezbollah's capabilities a year ago. We were working under the assumption that the amount of rockets, the amount of launchers, and the amount of personnel and capabilities that Hezbollah had, they'd be able to fire about 4,500 rockets at Israel every day. That was the working assumption of pre-October 7. Hezbollah, the highest they fired in one day is about 220. And with, thankfully, very little prices paid in the most important thing, which is human life. Yes, there's been destruction of property, but by and large, far, far below what we assessed Hezbollah's capabilities to be. And that isn't because they don't want to. That's because Israel has effectively degraded their military capabilities, struck their weapons depots, struck their rocket launchers, and struck the operators who were supposed to fire the rockets. And that happens through a lot of intel, also taking out their senior leadership, and of course, having the ability to infiltrate in their supply chain and deliver them faulty goods for them to use. The beepers was a very good success.
So guys, a kind of applause. We have time for one more question.
Heavy the burden.
Thank you so much. This is just amazing. And for those of us that are intercessors, which I suppose it's everybody, just the news that the West Bank or Judea Samaria has been kind of held back down as an answer to prayer of a big quilt over it to just... But the supply lines, do we have any intelligence as to how to cut off and in which areas the supply lines are coming through? Is it the Jordan Valley? Where it must be in the between Jericho and Bet-Sha'an that they're smuggling. Do you have a quick answer?
Thank you. So as I explained before, Israel, I think we have the heaviest workload of any country, fighting on a lot of fronts simultaneously. And when you have limited resources, which is what Israel has, you have to prioritize. And when you prioritize defensive infrastructure, intel, and military resources between Gaza, Lebanon, Judea and Samaria, Egypt and Jordan and Syria, then what eventually, and when you factor into that equation that we have a peace treaty with Jordan and with Egypt, the two borders that are the least defended are Egypt and, by a large margin, the border with Jordan. And what the Iranians, being cunny and serious operators on the ground, understood was that the Israeli-Jordanian border isn't very well defended. And that if they build an infrastructure of civilian smuggling using criminals, smugglers on both sides of the border, which is a pattern that they've used in other locations around the world as well, and they're very good at it, then what they can able to do is to smuggle weapons across the border and then have Bedouins or Arabs in Judea and Samaria deliver those weapons to terrorist organizations in Palestinian cities. And they've been very successful. You know, one, I think you're by the accent, you're American or born there. So you'd be surprised to see, I was surprised the first time around 1.5, 2 years ago, when I saw U.S.-made weapons in the hands of Palestinian terrorists in northern Samaria. Then I said, wow, this is interesting. Where did they get these weapons from? So the first assessment was that that criminals had stolen weapons from IDF bases in Israel, and then they'd been sold and trafficked to terrorists. But then when we checked the numbers imprinted on the serial number on the weapons, and we queried around, we understood that these were weapons that have been provided to two forces in the Middle East. One was the Afghani security forces, and the second was the Iraqi security forces. And then they had been either given or sold to gunrunners, and the Iranians picked them up and then bought them and delivered them to Palestinian terrorists. Now, they've been very successful so far, the Iranians, in getting explosives and rockets in. The top of the wish list for any terrorist anywhere around the world, if you wake them up in the northern Sahara or in Iran or in Yemen or in Chad or in any other place, you ask him, what kind of weapons do you want? He'll say, I want surface-to-air missiles and I want anti-tank missiles. That's what all terrorists want, because that is the most advanced weaponry that you can get that has a real strategic importance. They still haven't been able to get those, and I hope that they won't. But I am very concerned about the day where Palestinian terrorists will have access to surface-to-air missiles, and they'll be deployed in Samaria. They'll have the ability to deploy themselves very closely to Ben Gurion. And if they have long-range anti-tank missiles, they can sit on any of the hills in Judea and Samaria, and they can fire at civilian traffic on road number 6 and road number 4 in Israeli communities with tremendous ease, if they get the same weapons that Hezbollah has in Lebanon. So therefore, what Israel is doing now, and this will take time, infrastructure and troops, neither of which are in overflowing supply, but Israel will change the infrastructure all along the border with Jordan and build something similar to the infrastructure that we have along the Egyptian border and the Golan Heights. Tall fence, lots of sensors, and obstacles that will make it difficult. And we will have to deploy more troops there. Troops that sincerely we're in shortage of. So it's going to be a significant challenge. But some of it has been budgeted already. The government, in my humble opinion, is taking too long of a time to deal with the threat, even though the writing is right there and it's just waiting to happen. And I hope that they speed up their efforts and prioritize this over other political issues that they're busy with. But it's something that is doable, but will be require lots of resources.
We hope you enjoyed that briefing by Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus, the former IDF spokesman, just a real expert. And now that he's out of uniform, he can really share information. We think there was a lot packed in there to help us understand this conflict that Israel's been in for this past year. Now, if you want to see more of the feast content and you haven't signed up for the online feast, there's still time to do that. You can go to feast.icej.org and you can sign up and register and watch all the way through the end of January, all the good content, Bible teachings, current affairs, briefings, and all the other content that we had at the feast. Lots of good worship and prayer as well. And now stay tuned for next week. We'll be back with another ICJ webinar. And at the top of the hour at 4:00 Israel time, be sure to join us for the daily global prayer gathering brought to you by the International Christian Embassy in Jerusalem. You can pray with Christians from all over the world for Israel, for this region, and for all the countries that need to be supporting Israel, including your country, as we join together with Christians to pray for Israel. God bless you.